Here's welcome to Thailand. Thailand is agriculture country, and the Southeast Asia and Thailand, like in general, is all about the same in terms of geography and society. So we have a lot of farmers, like 70% of people is farmers. We grow rice and eat a lot of rice. And this is a canal. We have a lot of canal and do fishing. Southeast Asian, including Thailand, Khmer, I mean Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, they are Buddhist countries, so majority of them is Buddhist. This is market in Thailand, which is a lot of food that sell along the street. This is one of the pictures in the town that we were. It's far away from Bangkok, which is the capital, about 2 hours. Okay, this is the first group that we talk about that came to Thailand. It's Vietnam, Vietnamese, and Lao, and Khmer, and Hmong. He's one of our workers. He's Vietnamese.
Okay. There was a couple different reception camps for Vietnamese in Thailand. When they would come off the boats, a lot of them would be in really bad shape. These are some more Vietnamese. A lot of them were victims of piracy at sea, were robbed, many of the women were raped, and a large percentage never made it to Thailand or Malaysia. But when they did arrive in Thailand, they went first to police stations and then were transported to the camp that we worked at, which served as a holding center for all the Vietnamese in Thailand, as well as a transit center for refugees that had been accepted to be resettled in the West and were getting processing English classes, medical exams in preparation for being resettled in Western countries, of which the largest portion had gone to the United States. So this is a new group who's arrived in these little buses right from the coast, and we would then screen them medically and give what treatment would be needed.
It's very packed in the camp by the time we left. About last year, it's about 14,000. And Vietnamese or boat people still kept coming every day. And like you saw this, they make a building and they have to provide a building and a half. And this is like the whole family stay in that just that area. About 5 or 6 people. This is some of Vietnamese kids, and Vietnamese people, they like to make, like decorate a house and make the house bigger. They make another door, small door, you can see on the side.
The Vietnamese, in contrast to some of the other groups, tend to be urban and previously had lived in South Vietnam and were in the middle class and seen their, both had suffered repression as people that had previously been associated with the American supportive regime, and also people that had a deterioration in their economic status. So you've really got both political refugees and also an outflow of economic refugees like you might have from a lot of other countries. And that's one of the controversies about this refugee movement, is trying to see do these people really qualify as political refugees who really face persecution, or are they economic migrants? And it's very hard to draw a line sometimes, but we would see both. And the U.S. is supposedly committed to taking political refugees, but also people with family ties and previous association with the U.S. government and U.S. military in Southeast Asia.
This is the Khmer group, the second group that came to Thailand.
Khmer is Cambodian. The ethnic group from Cambodia are known as Khmer, as well as the language that they speak is called Khmer.
And most of them came by the border because it's next to Thailand. And now before we left, we start to have more Khmer people that came by boat because there's all the Khmer Rouge, they put the mine along the border and it's very hard to cross the border. This is some more Khmer kids.
Yes. Could you repeat or go into more detail about the reasons why they're moving?
Yeah, well, there's not much movement out of Kampuchea right now. The largest percentage of refugees have been refugees in Thailand for almost 10 years, at least since 1980. And when the Khmer Rouge was driven from power, they retreated to the border and a large Western assistance program developed to help the refugees that had flown into Thailand and to get food into Cambodia, which was suffering from starvation. And since that time, there's been a military occupation by Vietnam in Kampuchea. They support the present government there, which is a Cambodian, Kampuchean government, but it's supported with a Vietnamese military occupation, which similar maybe to Namibia, that it's supported mostly by an outside power. And however, its adversaries are the Khmer Rouge and a couple other small resistance groups on the border that are being supported by Western countries and by China. And so it's another area of superpower confrontation where you have Vietnam, which is supported by the Soviets with a military occupation, and resistance groups, which are supported by the West and by China, operating from Thailand, doing attacks into Kampuchea, similar to maybe the situation with the Contras attacking into Nicaragua or the Afghanis resistance in Pakistan attacking into Afghanistan. So for a lot of the refugees who fled in 1978 and 79 because of the possibility of getting food and medical care have never felt safe to return because there's been fighting in the country ever since then. A lot of them, although they lived through the horror of the Khmer Rouge years, don't trust the Vietnamese, don't want to live under a foreign occupation force, and are scared to go back. There's another reason that there's an increasing fear that the Khmer Rouge may come back to power in Kampuchea, which I'll talk about a little later.
This is Khmer lady that get ready to go to France, and she told me that she make a dry pickle fish, which is very hard to find in France, and she pack all that fish into the luggage and with her to France, and she like make about 10 times that make the profits about 10 times, so she's about to leave about the week after this. Yeah, a lot of refugees, they just pack. Like either they come to America or Canada, pack a lot of clothes because it's so cheap in Thailand. And it's very easy for them to go through the custom because they don't suspicious about that so much. Mm-hmm. Although they check a lot with Hmong with opium, which is Hmong have all kind of technique about to try to get opium out of Thailand. Okay, this is Lao. Lowland Lao, just come to the camp also.
Yeah, in Laos there's two very separate groups of people that are refugees in Thailand. Lowland Lao, which as with the Vietnamese are often urban people that had a previous association with the United States or had served in the military. Diminishing number of people in Thailand. A lot have been resettled in the United States. There's several thousand remaining that still have come and have been classified more as economic migrants and been rejected for resettlement, but are sort of caught in limbo and haven't wanted or been able to return back to Laos yet. This is some other Lao kids here.
This is another Lao kid in a camp. That in the camp you see a lot of people just carrying umbrellas, and these kids just come out along the street and set the umbrellas and make the house and sit by the garbage can and looking for toys and just playing there. It's another Lao that worked with us. This group is Hmong. Hmong is now one of the biggest group in inland refugee in Thailand. And they spend time, a lot of time, like during the weekend study and gather together among the family and get ready to come to America. So another thing that Hmong like to do is do a Hmong craft. Some of you might familiar with that they sell in Minnesota or some craft shop. Yeah. This is the family that on opium withdrawal, so they have to stay separate and have another fence, and they will repeat check urine every week and every month, make sure that they don't have opium. And so they just sit along the fence. Although there's still a lot of opium problem because Hmong just kind of born with opium. And they grow opium and they smoke. Even they can get through the immigration, like check urine and no problem. They can withdraw for a while, but they still go back. One of the one that very, very wonderful technique, I don't know wonderful or not, but the way that they try to take the opium out of the country, they try every technique. One of the techniques is when they pack, they use the box, like the cardboard box. So they tear the cardboard box, which you will know the cardboard box have two layers, right, in the middle. They tear it one layer and they lay the opium rubber in the middle and they put it back. So, and then they pack all that luggage to America. But later we get to know about that, so every time they get to the custom, the police will have something like the poke and poke the luggage, every luggage, to make sure that they don't have the rubber come out. But it's still a problem for them. This is another Hmong guy for traditional music. He just play along the street. This is Charmin. Hmong is not Buddhist. They believe in animus. So when they get sick, they have Charmin come to the house and pray and sing a song.
The Hmong were an ethnic minority in Laos who lived up in the hills as farmers, and they had been very removed from the whole war in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia until the 1960s, when the CIA went into Laos and recruited a great number of Hmong hill tribesmen as mercenary fighters to leave their hill areas and go down into southeastern Laos, where the Ho Chi Minh Trail was, and to fight against the Viet Cong there and against the Lao communist movement. They had been very removed from the war and probably could have stayed that way except for the activities of the CIA, which really dragged them into the war. When the Royal Lao government was defeated by the Hapit Lao communist government in 1975, the Hmong found themselves in a very difficult position, and that they were very closely identified with the American war effort. And a lot of them fled out of Laos across the Mekong River, which is shown here. We're on the Thai side, and that's Laos across on the other side. Not all of the Hmong were on the CIA side. There was, which this is not known so well, but Close to half of the Hmong are still in Laos. Many of them supported the communist side, and there's even Hmong in the cabinet of the Lao government at the present time. But many of them have felt persecuted and that they could not live under the current Lao government. And they, due to their very close involvement with the U.S. military and the CIA, they've had a relatively easy time to get resettled. There's another view of Laos across. They've had a relatively easy time to get resettled in the United States. Having gotten here, they've had a lot of difficulties adjusting from their simple existence in the hills of Laos to urban American neighborhoods. And they tended to move and cluster together in a few centers, Fresno, California being the largest, and St. Paul, Minnesota being the second largest, where there's currently almost 20,000, I believe. But having heard all the stories of how difficult things were, a lot of the Hmong in refugee camps in Thailand have refused to come to America and are waiting, I believe, pretty much in vain for the opportunity to go back to Laos. And there's still close to 50,000 in these camps in northern Thailand, some who've been here since been there since 1975, and there's slowly more of a movement prodded on by the Thai government to force them either to go back to Laos or come to the United States.
This is the MCH or maternal child health clinic that I work with, and this is one of the Lao patients. We do some school health. This is one of the Lao kids that is not easily seen because it looks so healthy.
Our efforts were not always appreciated.
So, and we do health education for the mother about for under five children. This is one of the handicaps, school for handicapped patient, and we train staff. The way that we do medical data, we try to be coordinator and train the refugee there to get to know the world, even become a medic or teacher, and they can help their group by themselves. It's another staff in the special school or school for handicap.
These are almost all Khmer Cambodian in the Phnom Nakhon camp, which was the transit camp.
This Vietnamese lady in transit camp also, they have the vocational program, they're making some sweater.
Yeah, they try to get skills that could help them in the United States, which includes both language and then vocational skills, and that helps a lot for them getting accepted by an embassy to be resettled, and then it also helps them once they get to the West.
We also have the cultural orientation, like consortium. A lot of them go to school, which is all the people that's coming to America have to go to school and study English and learn about culture. These people is going to school.
Yeah, so this part of the camp, this half is a pretty happy place. These people have been accepted to be resettled. Across the road is the Vietnamese Holding Center, where you saw the slides of before, where the vast majority have not been accepted, and some have been waiting for 5 or 7 years.
Okay. We have the market in the camp also. The camp is right just the middle on the road in the rural area, and they put the fence all around, and UN will provide our food and some supply, but there's not enough food for them. So some of Hmong people which have money from before, or the relative that already came to the third country sent back to Thailand, they will have some money to spend and buy some food in the market. This is another kid that like to play under the rain. This is spend time study during the weekend. This is Hmong people. This is one of the Vietnamese corner. They set up the tailor. And this corner is like we call Aran Jail, which is mean the Vietnamese group that was being a sawyer for the in the Khmer. And they came through
in the invasion or occupation army in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they deserted and came across into Thailand.
And they just stay there, like many of them still stay there for a long time because it's hard for them to get accepted in any country. Most of them will have a chance to go to like Scandinavian country because it was labeled as a communist.
Yeah, they have not been able to be resettled in the United States at all because they were served in a communist army, and so they've been rejected for resettlement. There's several hundred soldiers, deserted soldiers, who often stayed 5 years or more now.
It's just very hot in Thailand, so and a lot of flies. So the mother just used the fan to get rid of the hot, and then when they finish, they just put the fan on the face.
Water is a big problem in the dry season in the camps. In most of their locations, there's not enough natural water, and it has to be trucked in from reservoirs a considerable distance away. Water's at a real premium in the dry season. However, in the wet season, which is approximately half the year, there's more water than you can handle. So there's real extremes.
This is the kids that I saw a lot in the camp. They just play around the camp, and one of the hobby is looking for the garbage can. Just look through the garbage and take all the stuff that they can play with or they can use in the can. It's very normal to see Hmong, especially Hmong, the 3 or 4 years old take care for the little one infant, and the parents just go to school. They have daycare also that run by consortium, which is served by the U.S. government. But sometimes they prefer to have their kids take care infant.
There's also been many separated families, large numbers of orphans in the camps, and that sometimes hook up with another family, but that then causes problems if they're going to be resettled or try to repatriate back to Laos. And one friend of ours has been working specifically on this issue for several years, just trying to locate kids in the camps who have parents already in the United States and try to connect up with them. And I think he's on his 300th case or something now.
This is the daycare in the transit camp with Lao and Hmong kid. Another way to take a bath. When I work in the health education, it's very hard to get them take a bath or try to get clean because when they have disease, they just go all over in every family, like scabies and lice.
Okay, those previous shots there were all in the transit camp, which is inside Thailand and under the protection of the United Nations and the Thai government. Now, the other set of camps are right along the Cambodian border, where a quarter of a million Cambodians still live, and they are in a much more difficult situation. They're basically in a no man's land. Thailand has refused to allow them to come in further into Thailand and be classified as refugees, and they are not able to return to Cambodia, so they're really caught in a no man's land there. And since 1978, There's been a large Western supported relief operation to serve this population. And that's, our agency was also part of that on the border. This is in the town packing up in the morning to go into the camp with our supplies, and the pharmacy truck is the large truck there. At night, these camps become very unsafe. There's fighting between different factions, and they're also used for recruiting for these resistance groups that are fighting against the Vietnamese supported government in Kampuchea. And that's where we get into a lot of controversy. There's a special UN agency that's financing this, the United Nations Border Relief Operation, which is about 80% funded by the United States. This is a large water truck they're bringing in to distribute water. There's also rice distribution for the population. Now, in 1978, when the Khmer Rouge was defeated, they were a destroyed force, and most of their army was starving, and they had been disorganized and were basically on the complete verge of collapse when they came into Thailand. And one of the controversial aspects of this relief operation is that it has allowed the Khmer Rouge to rebuild itself. And there's been large diversions of Western aid to support the Khmer Rouge. There's also been diplomatic support for the Khmer Rouge combined with two other smaller non-communist resistance groups, which has gained UN recognition as the legitimate government of Kampuchea. So the Vietnamese-supported government is very isolated and has not received any Western diplomatic recognition because of its support from an outside power, Vietnam. These are some other shots here of one of the border encampments, which are very crowded. There's high incidence of disease, malaria, typhoid fever. There's a very large shortage of water. You see here people getting their daily ration of water, which is usually a couple buckets per family. None at all for bathing. There's a small market, black market, that exists in these camps and allows them, if they have some money, to buy some other food beyond the basic rations.
Another picture that we didn't have here, but it's very chaos when we have a chance to see when they distribute rice. They will stand in a long line, and just only the women or the girls can get rice because they didn't want any men, and they seem to think that men will get the rice and serve the army. So if you go to the border camp, you can see all the girls, all the boys that have long hair, or the teenager boy the face look like the boy but have a long hair and makeup, especially the day that they have distribution rice.
The refugee camps on the border are under the control of different resistance groups that are fighting against the government in Kampuchea. Several of them are including the one our agency worked in, were under the control of a non-communist resistance group that was in a coalition with the Khmer Rouge, which controlled several other refugee camps and a large civilian population on the border. And in many ways, these refugee camps are prison camps, and the people that are caught in them are not allowed, they cannot go further into Thailand to seek asylum under UN protection for their activities. I think for anyone who saw the movie The Killing Fields, it's probably hard to imagine, but now our government and other Western governments are in many ways supporting the Khmer Rouge in their military struggle to take back Kampuchea. The current government certainly has its problems, but no Cambodians that I spoke to thought that it was anywhere near as bad as the Khmer Rouge and what they suffered through during the Khmer Rouge years. And I think that that's one of the real issues that I'm concerned with now, is the diplomatic support that our government is continuing to give this Khmer coalition, and which it relates to the Reagan doctrine of supporting efforts, military resistance efforts against Soviet-supported governments. And often these resistance fighters are called freedom fighters. And in...
Excuse me, weren't the Khmer Rouge communists also?
Yeah, and that's the ironic part of it, is that they're a much more hardline... The regime in Kampuchea, which is known as the People's Republic of Kampuchea, is still a socialist government. It's much more moderate than the Khmer Rouge was. There's still human rights problems. They're nowhere near to the extent that they were under the Khmer Rouge. But we found it to be opportunistic to support the Khmer Rouge as the largest, most viable resistance force against Vietnam's client government in Kampuchea. It's a very complicated issue, and I'll be glad to take some more questions. It's not an easy issue to really see who the good guy. I mean, some areas of the world, I think you can see who the good guys are, maybe, and it's much harder in this situation, because it tends to be that they all seem to be bad guys that are fighting against each other, and it's a very complex situation. I'm not sure if I can get it across very clearly in just an hour, but there's since 1978, when Vietnam invaded Kampuchea, and the resistance groups began on the border, they've been supported to a large extent by China, which, and in many ways, this is a super power conflict between China and the Soviet Union more than it is between the US and the Soviets, because China has been the biggest supporter of the Khmer Rouge. But they've done that with the willingness of Thailand, which has allowed military assistance to be funneled through Thailand to the Khmer Rouge, which is still in 1988 run by Pol Pot, who was known as the dictator during the Khmer Rouge years. It's periodically claimed that he has stepped down and that the Khmer Rouge had changed their tactics and are moderating now. The people that I know that have visited the Khmer Rouge camps just think that is completely a propaganda ploy to try to win more Western assistance and recognition. They, as this slide kind of shows, they live in a prison camp, the population there, and it's only with the ascent of Thailand and really the United States, which has a lot of influence in Thailand, provides a large amount of military aid, around $100 million a year. And if they really wanted to, could force that the Khmer Rouge to give up that civilian population that they're holding hostage. And so it's a real tough situation. There's been, however, in the last year, some real signs of hope that there'd be some resolution of this conflict, in that for the first time some of the different factions that are fighting, and now just this week, actually China and the Soviet Union are sitting down to discuss this issue and try to come up with a peaceful settlement. I think that's it for the slides, and I'll be glad to continue talking and answering some more questions. Any impressions or questions that people have?
The children seemed to be cared for quite well. They looked like they were fed pretty well. Is that typical, or is that just the pictures that we see here?
I think that's typical of the refugee camps inside Thailand, where those refugees that have, from Laos, Vietnamese boat people that have come in, and Khmers that got out of the border encampments on into Thailand under UN protection have been cared for very well. It's been credited as one of the most effective refugee relief situations. Now, in the border encampments right along the border, where over half the refugees in this region are, that's not the case, and there's a lot of malnutrition. A lot of the aid that's given never gets where it's supposed to be.
The picture that proves is like in the camp, the transit camp, and I work in Velvet Weekly, like we raise a kid every month, which is, you know, we don't do that in Thailand. Every month, we check every month and we make sure we teach them you have to eat this and what you don't eat and eat a supply that you have. And they have pretty good percentage of the day.
Yes.
Do you know anything about work in Cambodia? I have a friend who's going with Memory Central Committee into Cambodia to do medical work.
Yeah.
Is it open? Is Cambodia presently open to?
It's not open just for someone to go and visit as a tourist very easily, although it's been opening up more that way in the last couple years. The U.S. actually had a prohibition against any development assistance that went through the government of Kampuchea until just last year. That was eased. It's still restricted, but there are a number of non-government agencies, both American ones include Oxfam, American Friends Service Committee, Mennonite Central Committee, Church World Service, and as well as international agencies like UNICEF and some Western European agencies, in addition to a large amount of assistance from the Soviet bloc. They are functioning on a pretty small level, and I'm hoping that is able to expand, because I think that really gets to one of the key issues here, and that is in how is this refugee flow stopped, and what really needs to happen is that the situation becomes tolerable for people to live in these countries, and In Kampuchea, the main need is for peace, for a peaceful solution. But there's also a need for all sorts of economic, medical, agricultural assistance. And the response of Western countries has been similar to our response to Nicaragua or something, where there's been a trade boycott and a ban on any developmental assistance through governments. And I think that that's really counterproductive, because if the refugee flow is really going to be stemmed, there needs to be more reasons for people to stay in those countries. But so far, we haven't really been willing even to talk much to those governments.
Is our government giving aid to Khmer Rouge? Or there was something where you said some of the things have been sidetracked.
Well, the U.S. officially is not supporting the Khmer Rouge with any aid. They fund this special UN agency at 80% of its funding, which a lot of that aid is used to support the Khmer Rouge. We also diplomatically support the Khmer Rouge dominated coalition to the United Nations, recognizing them as the... Yeah, it is pretty hard to imagine sometimes. But officially we're committed to having both the Vietnamese leave Kampuchea and a government take over that's not dominated by the Khmer Rouge. That's where it gets real tricky, because the Khmer Rouge is by far the largest resistance group and could probably topple the government in Kampuchea if the Vietnamese totally withdrew their troops.
They're starting to withdraw.
Yeah, they have said that they wanted withdraw by 1990. And Vietnam is facing real bad economic problems and is having trouble sustaining, I think, this extended occupation of Kampuchea, and is also getting pressure from the Soviets, which are trying to improve relations with China. But a lot of people that have worked in this area really do share this concern about the Khmer Rouge coming back to power, as well as do a lot of Khmer people. And in fact, right now in the U.S. Congress, there's bills. One, it passed in the House of Representatives and is, I believe, still being debated in the Senate, that are resolutions instructing the State Department to do whatever they can to prevent the return of the Khmer Rouge from power. And I think that this is a real positive step. The U.S. really has limited influence in this situation, I think, compared to China and the Soviet Union and what they resolved between the two of them. But I think this continued support for the Khmer Rouge, and both diplomatically and through this aid effort, is really unconscionable.
Where does Sihanouk enter the picture?
Yeah, I haven't really talked about him very much, because there's a lot of different things to go over. Prince Sihanouk, who's the deposed ruler of, well, Cambodia before 1970, and he was in exile in China in the early 70s when it was under a military government, and was in somewhat of an alliance with the Khmer Rouge as a figurehead, but is really not a supporter of the Khmer Rouge. He had many members of his family killed by Khmer Rouge. He leads one of the three resistance groups that's fighting against the Vietnamese occupation. I said the Khmer Rouge was the largest group, and then Prince Sihanouk has another group fighting of followers loyal to him. And then there's another group called the Khmer People's National Liberation Front, which is a another group, right-wing military organization that's fighting against the Vietnamese. And that's the organization that is most strongly supported by the United States. But Sihanouk is the head, or has been the head of this coalition of these three groups, but is seen as still somewhat of a figurehead in that the Khmer Rouge have the military power in the coalition. But he has, in fact, stepped down this last year as head of this coalition because he said the Khmer Rouge that he was supposedly in alliance with was attacking his own forces. So there was a lot of fighting between the resistance groups on the border. He's still very active in the peace effort right now and in the negotiations. He met for the first time with representatives of the Kampuchean government recently, and it is still, I think he's a real key person because he's still very much respected by a lot of Khmers, both in the country and without, and his agreement to if he would agree to some type of peace settlement that could stop the fighting, I think that he offers probably one of the best chances for some type of settlement that would not include the Khmer Rouge. Are we getting close to Vespers then?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, I probably created more questions than answers. And but it's a start anyway. I probably should take a series of talks to get through it all. But
did you have a sponsor to send you over there?
I was employed by the American Refugee Committee, which is a non-government agency based in Minneapolis that supported from foundations a number of private contributions. And in Thailand, we got support both from the United Nations and from the Refugee Resettlement Office of the U.S. government. And so I worked as an employee of that group, which also is active in domestic resettlement of refugees in the United States, especially in Minnesota, Chicago. And Thu was a Thai employee of ours as a nurse.